similar opportunities, and Wilson, and you know, similar political constituencies, and Wilson failed utterly, and FDR succeeded.
To understand geopolitics, you must have the freedom to be honest.
The More Freedom Foundation podcast.
Rob, what do you think US presidents, what big hitters spring to mind?
Well, today we're going to be talking about two of them, Rory, that came in actually fairly quick succession. I want to be talking about Woodrow Wilson, who was U.S. president from 1913 to 1921, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was U.S. president from 1933 to 1945. These guys are, it's an oversimplification, well, not much of an oversimplification, but these are basically the World War I president and the World War II president. To put it in the most reductive way possible. But there's a lot more to these guys, and this is part two. You don't have to listen to part one, but you can. A little unit we're doing on early American empire. We talked last episode about the way that U.S. empire transitioned from a more democratic, democratically savage and brutal continental empire with the Spanish-American War in 1898, to a more elite-driven, but just as brutal empire. And we talked about it through the career of Smedley Butler, an incredibly unique and fascinating general. The Smedley Butler's world began to fade away with Woodrow Wilson. But I think what's underappreciated about Woodrow Wilson is just how much of the actual play-by-play of Woodrow Wilson's presidency, the actual foreign policy activity, was still incredibly rooted in the savagery of that early American empire and Smedley Butler's world. So what Woodrow Wilson did was introduce higher ideals, and I think, as we'll talk about at length in this episode, Woodrow Wilson was a kind of a failure in a lot of ways. And then it was Roosevelt who sort of brought all the strands together and finally made U.S. control of the world, which was really on offer since 1917. I'm not too big into the great man theory of history, but I think if Woodrow Wilson had been a better and smarter man, we could have had a stable American empire. I mean, not saying we definitely would have, but we could have had a stable American empire in the 1920s. Which we did not get, and Woodrow and Franklin Delano Roosevelt gave to us in the 1930s and 1940s. So that's what I want to talk about today, Woodrow Wilson versus FDR.
Is the America that Woodrow Wilson would have known, would it have been, the government didn't really meddle, not meddle, but it wasn't really there to affect you in a lot of ways. I'm sure a lot of Americans could have been incredibly remote and organized things on a state level. And the concept of, you know, the federal government helping them much wouldn't have happened.
If you asked, say, a business person or a more fervent sort of states' rights conservative activist or something that, during Woodrow Wilson's time in power, they'd tell you that Woodrow Wilson was one of the most invasive and dictatorial and controlling totalitarian people imaginable. But of course, you're absolutely right. By the standards of 1923, you know, what Woodrow Wilson was getting up to before World War I seems impossibly distant federal government. But Woodrow Wilson, along with Teddy Roosevelt, the cousin of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was president at the beginning of the 20th century, who we discussed last time, and Taft as well, the guy who was president in between the first Roosevelt and Wilson, were all seen as progressive generals. Taft, much less so, were seen as progressives who were trying to craft a larger, more professionalized role for the federal government. And of course, FDR took that to the moon in a lot of big ways. But that is, yeah, that is a very, very valid point to talk about. In this period, the role of the U.S. federal government was not as small as it was, say, before the U.S. Civil War in the 1860s, but was still tiny by the standards of today.
And I don't think the average American would expect help from the federal government if, say, there was a natural disaster. That was kind of your hard luck and you'll have to deal with it.
I think there's some real truth to that. Don't we have churches for that? And back then they had a lot more churches for that.
Mm-hmm. That had a lot more power.
Indeed. It was a different division of roles and powers for sure. And Wilson, I mean, some of the better aspects of Wilson, which I used to in my more libertarian days, is the worst aspects of Wilson were that he actually moved forward a number of progressive ideals.
Do the libertarians not like Wilson?
Oh, yeah. I made a video a decade ago saying that Woodrow Wilson was our worst president by far.
Mm-hmm. Do you still believe that?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Oh, man, so much worse than Trump. Even worse than George W. Bush. Wilson squandered some opportunities, but he didn't squander as many opportunities as George W. Bush did, and to no purpose. To some extent, you know, Wilson's choice to involve us in World War I was a cataclysmic mistake from which all of the horror of the 20th century extends. I really don't like Woodrow Wilson. But of course, George W. Bush, didn't have World War I going on. Wilson did have hard decisions to be made, and he failed to make the right one. But to some extent, World War I was imposed on Woodrow Wilson. The George W. Bush's murdering of utopia with the invasion of Iraq, you know, just sort of pissing away the Cold War bonus, the end of the Cold War bonus and peace breaking out, his reintroduction of the idea that countries should conquer other countries, that was entirely his choice. So while I think that it's just that Woodrow Wilson's failures were so much, you know, the World War III, that's George W. Bush's hideously stupid actions will eventually generate, hasn't happened yet.
What a horrifying thought.
The World War II that Woodrow Wilson's horrifyingly stupid actions begot, we've seen. George W. Bush hasn't created his Hitler yet, but Woodrow Wilson has created his Hitler. So we can call him the worst president, I would say.
Fantastic.
What's interesting is, for me personally, but also the evolution of the reputations of Woodrow Wilson and FDR over the course of my life, my adult life, my life paying attention to things. Woodrow Wilson has deservedly suffered a calamitous drop in his reputation since 2020. In 2020, specifically, a lot of the people who had spent so much time celebrating Woodrow Wilson over the past half century got a lot, you know, academics, media types, got the opportunity to look a lot more closely at Wilson's attitudes towards race relations, which are horrific.
Yes, they have not aged well at all.
No, he was a monstrous racist. I went to Tulsa, the site of a race massacre, a famous site of a race massacre in 1920. And they talk a lot about Birth of a Nation, which was one of the first great blockbuster films in the silent era.
Didn't it rekindle the Ku Klux Klan?
It had a large role to play in that, to say the least. It's a huge... And it was basically, it's apparently still celebrated as grand filmmaking, but it is a epic film about the glories of the Ku Klux Klan. And Woodrow Wilson had it screened at the White House multiple times.
For some reason, I'm imagining in it, you know, when they do a projection onto a building, I'm just imagining it with loudspeakers literally onto the White House.
Yeah, I don't think that's quite how they did it.
No.
But might have had an orchestra at that point, because I think it's a silent film. I've seen stills and passages from it. It's a long, long film about the Civil War and losing the Civil War and how sad that was, and then how the heroic Ku Klux Klan
I haven't seen it. I didn't even consider it to be about losing the World War, or the Civil War, if you know what I mean. I just assumed it would be on the Yankee side, but yes.
I've only seen clips, but no, it's about losing the Civil War and then the heroic rise of the Ku Klux Klan that that kicked all the and these, of course, are all the African Americans are portrayed by white people in blackface. You know, kicked them all out of power and took the vote away from them, and how heroic that was. It's a disgusting film, and Woodrow Wilson was a disgusting man. He is seen as one of our most intellectual presidents. He was, I believe, the president of Princeton before he was president of the United States. He's seen as this intellectual. He's seen as having all these high-minded ideals, but he was also a Southern man and a Southern bigot. And he's pretty gross.
And born in 1956, that would be some industrial strength racism.
He was born in 1856, you said?
Yes. Yeah. So if you consider the era, that is just horrendous what he'd be spiting.
Oh, that's interesting. So he would remember, I didn't think about that, but yeah, he'd remember the Civil War. He'd have memories of the end of the Civil War. That is...
Going to affect him?
Yeah, he's... But what's interesting is certainly, maybe this is just the amount of time I spent in Washington, D.C. in my 20s, but he, you know, it's...
As we all do.
Yeah, as is common. Just constantly talking about Woodrow Wilson and his impact. It's Wilsonian. The world order is called Wilsonian, and we talk, I think until recently, there was a Wilson School of Public Policy, or multiple Wilson Schools of Public Policy. You know, his 14 points, his heroic standing up for the ideals of national self-determination in the aftermath of World War I. And it's fascinating the degree to which Wilson has been celebrated over the past 40 years, and I almost wonder if this is another artifact of Reaganism. It's because we really, really don't want to celebrate FDR for those things. I think that FDR has never become an unpopular figure. More broadly, he's the man who won World War II. You know, like, he will never be...
Well, because isn't America's role in World War I much more muted? While, you know, America, it's hard to argue America didn't essentially win World War II.
Yeah.
Was just a one of many moving parts in World War One.
I mean, we won World War II with Russian bodies. That's important to mention. It was Russian suffering and Russian suffering and U.S. Money.
The Soviet Union is the army. The British Empire is the Air Force, and America is the factory.
The arsenal democracy was a term that I can't recall, actually, and I've just read this. I've been researching this. I can't remember if it was Woodrow Wilson or I think it was probably FDR. It was the World War II era. The arsenal of democracy was the terminology that FDR
but
used.
But also, I feel it's hard to argue that America was the ultimate winner because, you know, their cities weren't destroyed and full of corpses.
Yeah. However, I do want to push back a little on, in World War II, Britain's only strategy was to hang on until the Americans joined. Like, there wasn't any other, like, we can do it, we can hold on long enough for the U.S. to come in and save us. Like, that was the only policy that Britain had. In World War I, and I argue in my upcoming book, American Empire, the First 100 Years, that really... U.S. Empire started in 1917, and I just finished a chapter talking about that incredible switch that happened between 1914 and 1917. For the first 3 years of World War I, the United States was consciously not a factor in the war. Woodrow Wilson ran for re-election in 1916 and won on the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." So absolutely, we were not a factor in the war until 1917, when we instantly went from some sort of also-ran on the other side of the world that was selling a lot of goods to the combatant parties, we went from that to instantly the most powerful country of the world. And that's the opportunity that Woodrow Wilson squandered, because we instantly, for purely financial reasons, became the country that mattered the most in the world.
What was wrong with the 14 points?
Nothing necessarily was wrong with the 14 points. This was a number of very high-minded suggestions that Woodrow Wilson laid out as the sort of the negotiating position of the United States. I think the problem was that Woodrow Wilson did not have the negotiating wherewithal, the good sense or the sense of strategy necessary to make any of them true. and what is a vital corollary of those 14 points that include a lot of lovely language about self-determination and people should be able to go their own way, this, that, and the other thing, is that he very much only intended it to apply to white people. Wilson, when he went to, foolishly argued by many historians, went to personally negotiate the Treaty of Versailles, was the most famous person in the world and was actually a beloved one in many respects, because a lot of the subjects of European empires read the 14 points and saw the, had already had an idealized version of what the United States was, and saw what this U.S. president, who he'd instantly developed this incredible power over all of their imperial ministers, was promising, and their hopes were brought up dramatically. I think I remember reading something about, like, Ho Chi Minh being a student in Paris, being like, oh, Woodrow Wilson, he's amazing, you know, like just every, the hopes that were brought up by this, and then utterly dashed by the reality of what Woodrow Wilson, the minutiae of this is something I'm still parsing. There's a lot spinning in my head right now, trying to research all this stuff. But Wilson failed to use the power that he had over the British and the French to extort or to put together a fairer peace in Europe, to put together a quicker settlement to imperial questions. Realistically, Britain, the only empire that mattered before, that really mattered before 1914, did not have the resources to maintain its empire any longer. And if Woodrow Wilson had imposed higher costs on Britain for literally saving that country's ass in the war, just briefly, in 1916, I believe it was, so France and Britain were carrying Russia's war effort from, I don't know, what it's, the war started in mid 1914, probably by the end of 1914, or maybe it was 1915. By 1916, France had essentially become insolvent. They no longer could, had the money or find the money to continue their war efforts. So the British had to start bankrolling their efforts as well. And by the end of 1916, spring of 1917, Britain was essentially broke. And this was already, the British and the French already owed incredible amounts of money to the bankers in New York. And what happened in the beginning of 1917 is the bankers in New York said, like, well, we, I mean, it wasn't quite what it is today, but like, we have duties to our shareholders and we simply cannot put any more money down this black hole. The United States government had to step in. And U.S. soldiers were important in breaking, I think, the last German offensive and whatnot in 1918.
Just the sheer number of Americans just sort of broke Germany, because it was like, we can keep on fighting, but they've got all these reserves of Americans. So although, you know, there was still definitely brutal fighting, it was almost just like, we can't just go through another empire, essentially.
Yeah, that was a really important dynamic in 1918. But in 1917, without U.S. money that started being provided in the spring of 1917, the British war effort would have ended and Germany would have won.
Was this one way Britain prevented America from siding with Germany, was the fact that, you know, they're lending so much money that they want them to win?
100%. It can be portrayed as overly cynical, but I think it's the main reason why the United States joined the war.
Not the Zimmerman telegram?
Definitely not the Zimmerman telegram, which is the purported German offer of an alliance with Mexico against the United States. Though the Zimmerman telegram is a good segue to something else worth mentioning, which is that Woodrow Wilson put out the 14 points, had this incredibly high-minded language about what he was going to do and how he was going to handle things. But really, he had all this language and had all these approaches to what he was talking about because he had to sell Wall Street's war. He was not in the position to make those things happen because nobody had really thought about making those sorts of things happen. Woodrow Wilson was a progressive president from the context of, we're going to make a stronger, cleaner U.S. government for white people. But he was an active enemy of people of color or people who weren't from even Northern Europe having self-determination. And he was always an enemy. And this other Zimmermann telegram, the reason that Germany might have been sending such a telegram to Mexico is because the Wilson administration was in the process of invading failed invasions of Mexico at that point. It's something I've covered. Actually, I think we covered this in a couple of Mexico episodes on the podcast. The Mexicans had a revolution starting in 1910, 1911 or thereabouts. Actually resolved fairly quickly until the U.S. ambassador, another Wilson, no relation to Woodrow Wilson, colluded to have that president killed. Mexico fell into a horrible civil war for a decade that actually ended up in one of the last physical invasions of the United States by Pancho Villa, a Mexican revolutionary, and then was followed by a bunch of punitive expeditions from the United States into Mexico that led to nothing. And that was Woodrow Wilson's policy towards Latin America the entire time. There are many, 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 many differences between Woodrow Wilson and FDR. But I think one of the chief ones, and I think one of the thing that made all the difference in FDR's success, not all the difference, but made a big difference in FDR's success, was that FDR's respect for other peoples of the world was more legitimate. I'm not saying it's 100% legitimate. You know, he's still a U.S. president, U.S. government. Yeah. We are in charge. That's our main priority, and we'll say anything or do anything to make that more effective. And FDR, as part of that strategy, did carry out a few real things that at least appeared to show real respect for other countries in Latin America, in Asia, across the planet. Woodrow Wilson spoke and created this incredibly high-minded language around these things and did nothing in practice. We talked a lot about Smedley Butler's horrific rampage through Latin America in the last episode. Most of that was happening while Woodrow Wilson was president. This great guy for self-determination did not take a single U.S. troop out of anywhere. Also intervened in the intervened in the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union was attempting to establish itself, Wilson set the troops in, which should fairly be depicted as the launch of the Cold War, but somehow falls out of the histories. There was one point about Woodrow Wilson and FDR. So FDR has never not been loved as the winner of World War II, but over the past 40 years, there has been a concerted effort to discredit FDR's other legacy, which is social spending, social security.
Because it's communism.
It's communism. It's socialistic. The whole New Deal, oh, that was just crap. That didn't really help with the Great Depression, this, that, and the other thing. And I think part of that systematic devaluation of FDR's legacy is the fact that Wilson was lifted into being seen as the creator of the American world order. Everything's Wilsonian. That's the ticket. When in reality, Wilson was a desperate failure whose efforts at world ordering created World War II. And it was FDR, actually, who was the father of the United Nations, introduced the good neighbor policy that brief magical decade or two led to actually decent relationships between the United States and Latin America. The guy who won World War II, the guy who kind of set, I've got a paragraph, it might go a little too far, but I got a paragraph in the book currently, you know, titled American Solon. You know, I think Solon was the famous lawgiver for Athens, or perhaps it was another Greek city, I can't remember. I mean, that really, like, he sort of established the modern world, but a lot of the world we live in today is Reaganite, and Reaganism is defined in opposition to FDR's legacy. So everyone goes to this weird Southern racist who had a breakdown and failed to create the League of Nations,
which America then didn't join.
Exactly. So yeah, Wilson. There's a great passage in another book I'm reading, The Tragedy of U.S. Foreign Policy, by Walter McDougall. Fascinating book. This guy's like, was clearly like a Reagan conservative historian, which, you know, being a conservative academic in the United States is, of course, difficult in some ways, but is also a fabulous grift. You know, you get paid attention to in certain circles. You get, you know, money, this, that, and everything. And I think he was, you know, proud Reaganite in the 1990s, and then he watched what George W. Bush did in utter disgust and horror. I'm reading his polemic now, and he's got this great passage on Woodrow Wilson on just like the many things he did not understand. He did not understand his allies. He did not understand the war that was being fought. He did not understand anything about the world, and he did not understand neither the American Republic nor the U.S. legislature. Yeah, I mean, Wilson was just known as the president of Princeton, our professor president, and he was a moron. He was deluded. He had this sense of himself as a near messianic figure, he failed. He failed miserably. He was supposed to keep us out of the war. He did not. He created a massively more powerful U.S. government, which was used to better effect by folks like FDR and the presidents that followed, to fight this war that, honestly, he didn't have to send a single soldier to be the dictator of the peace. But he failed to do that because he had no sense of strategy, and he got run over by our allies that owed us billions and billions of dollars.
I think UK only paid it off in like the 21st century.
You know, on multiple occasions, I have sat down and been like, okay, did this money ever get paid off? And I feel like I get differing accounts from different folks.
I think World War I's paid off. World War II might still be getting paid.
I think a lot of British and French debt from World War I got forgiven because Germany renounced the reparations. Germany under Hitler stopped paying reparations, and I think at that point, some categories of French and British World War I debt to the United States just stopped being paid. But some of it was. It's every time I try to research this, I
get different answers.
Yeah, I get different answers. But that is definitely something I need to track down for this book, because that was a huge part of the way that the U.S. controlled and contributed to world governance in the 1920s, backing away from in the 1930s, unfortunately, was through a series of financial plans where in the United States reorganized the debts of the British, the French, and the Germans. Because the United States could simply do that, because that was the amount of financial power we had over these countries in that era, was we would simply determine their foreign relations and their fiscal relations. In these grand international plans named after like lawyers from California or something along those lines, you know, just random, you know, I don't know, I can't recall who Dawes and Young were, but we had immense, immense power, and Woodrow Wilson just utterly flummed it. He wanted to, the League of Nations was his baby. He wanted to set up this world government that the United States would obviously have a huge, huge role in. And I think you can make the argument that it would have been better had he been successful in this and had he been capable of creating this organization. But I think the extent that he simply did not know the American public or the American legislature was that it was just an idea that either the United States was simply flatly not ready for in 1920, 1921, or had to be argued for with a great deal more savvy and common sense and knowledge of the world that Woodrow Wilson just didn't effing have.
What shaped FDR before he became prime minister? Or what shaped FDR before he became president?
Extraordinary privilege, for sure. The Delano family was incredibly, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was. Oh, interestingly, yeah, this is a point that I'd seen recently. The Delano family made its money selling opium to China, which is.
Wow.
Which is all. This is a fun detail there. But the Roosevelt family, also quite wealthy, produced two presidents in the early 20th century. You know, I was thinking recently, it's like the only Dutch people are WASPs, but really, like, it's incredible how few they are white Anglo-Saxon Protestants.
Yeah.
Oh, no, they're not Anglo-Saxon. So they're not.
Yeah,
they're not. Okay. But as far as like non-WASP presidents, we've got like Eisenhower, Obama, Kennedy, Biden, and three Dutch guys. Martin Van Buren and the two Roosevelts. Just kind of an interesting thing to think about. Roosevelt was a wealthy New Yorker. I don't think he ever technically had to work a day in his life. But he got into public service early. I want to say he was I might be confusing him with the other Roosevelt, but was he a Secretary of the Navy or something during the? Maybe I think too early for him to be that during World War One. I think, but he was the governor of New York during the early years of the Great Depression, and did a creditable enough job of that to be given the job of running the country. He was a consummate elitist. I think that in contrast to Harry Truman, his successor, who was one of the most blue-collar presidents we've ever had, I think that definitely left Truman at a disadvantage in dealing with Churchill, or I guess very quickly had to deal with Attlee instead, or Stalin, or just European diplomats more generally. Roosevelt, diplomacy, intricacies of dealing with people were Roosevelt's bread and butter. It's interesting. Both, did Wilson die in office? I can't, but he was incapacitated for his last years anyway. Roosevelt died in office, and just the sheer contrast between how they were remembered. I don't think Wilson was much lamented, which is surprising because in the early years of World War One, he was the extent to which he had a personality cult around him in the United States is enforced in some very authoritarian ways. He's underappreciated. There's this poster of him hanging in one of my favorite museums in Northern Michigan. It's not a poster of him. It's a poster of hundreds of people in a field posing themselves so as to make the outline of his face. It is just very North Korea dear leader stuff. But by the time he died, just a few years later, died in office,
he didn't die in office, I apologize.
He did not die in office.
He died in 1924.
Okay, so 3 years
later.
3 years
out of office.
But he was incapacitated, my understanding is. There's some question of whether in his last 6 months to a year, because after his, perhaps during or helping to cause his dramatic failure to get the League of Nations through the Senate, I don't know if he had a stroke. There's actually some suggestion that he might have caught the Spanish flu that killed so many people in 1918, and that impacted him in a number of ways. But I think there's some indication that his wife was actually sort of taking on some
presidential
power.
Isn't that always
power.
That thing where it's like, theoretically, there's been a female president?
Theoretically.
There seems to be a lot of like suffrage went through during that period.
Oh, really? Oh, that's funny. I hadn't thought that through too much.
Because she was the only one that could translate what he was saying.
Ah, yes, yes. But when Wilson died, he was not particularly lamented, is my sense. When FDR died in 1945, it was a thunderclap. And it just reading accounts of this and talking about how the many very diverse and strange collection of aides that he'd collected around himself over 12 years in power. These people had nothing in common. I mean, well, from, you know, Truman, a hat seller from Missouri, to some of the most powerful capitalists in the country who had just decided to associate themselves with Roosevelt's project because the man was so compelling and was clearly saving the country. I mean, they would talk about how he was incredibly frustrating because he would not advance their agendas in the way that they wanted him to advance their agendas. But then in retrospect, and certainly after they lost him, they'd realize that he had just had this intuitive political sense of what was possible at a given time and what was not. I would never put FDR in the same category as Abraham Lincoln, who is a secular saint. The more I read about him, the more I'm like, this just seems like he's some kind of Like, is this Luke Skywalker or something? Mm-hmm. Like, he just doesn't
so
seem
is
like
he a... your only S-tier president?
Yes. I mean, Abraham Lincoln I think he was probably the only president I can point to and say that was a legitimately good person. I'm not even convinced that George Washington was, which is still sacrilege. Abraham Lincoln was on another plane. But there is some, and something that's underemphasized about Abraham Lincoln is that part of his otherworldliness was the extent to which he knew what he could get away with the American public. And his incredible, almost supernatural sense of how to bring about emancipation at the right times, how to govern the country through war. FDR had some of that. Woodrow Wilson had none of that. And I think that's a very important contrast between the two. I'm not saying FDR was a good man necessarily, but he was a consummate political animal. And some of that might come from his upbringing in New York City elites.
So just New Yorkers are better? Is that the gist?
Absolutely, Rory. Abso-effing-lutely. No, that's not true. I don't generally. I've noticed myself more and more identifying with New York City, which is strange, because I never have really before in my life, despite being born here. Yeah, but I left when I was a kid. But yeah, I guess I've been here just long enough, you know? I passed the 5-year mark, so I'm like, yeah.
You got your New York citizenship?
Well, technically, I lived here. I was born here and lived here till I was 9. So really, I'm at 14 years. So that's, that's technically.
It counts for something.
Yeah. So I'm gonna become just more and more. We can chart my transformation into one of those New York supremacists. I do think there is something to be said. That environment of privilege can produce some really, really awful, awful people. But it can also produce some people with great capacities.
Do you think he would have had more of a multicultural upbringing?
Gosh, I don't know. I would say that it's interesting you read about Cornelius Vanderbilt, or figures of Dutch extraction who are 50 to 100 years older than he is. And I think they would have grown up in the early 19th century in a context where there were still people who spoke Dutch language or a Dutch patois. There were still neighborhoods on, I think, Staten Island. I think Cornelius Vanderbilt came from Staten Island that were still predominantly Dutch, even 150 years after the Dutch lost control of New York City. I think that by the time FDR was being raised, I would assume that would have been more to the past. And certainly there was a very limited degree of cosmopolitanism. Like, FDR would like respect and have friendships with Jewish people, but only a certain kind of Jewish person, which is the sort of the kind of Jewish person, not who like came over in the 1890s, but whose parents had come over in the 1820s and were really established in banking circles or that sort of thing. Certainly FDR, to win power as the governor of New York City at that point, would have had to have been much more conversant and acceptable to Irish populations, Italian populations, Slavic populations, than like your average American president. Certainly than Woodrow Wilson or Harry Truman, the much put upon successor to FDR. To that extent, he would have had just being in and around New York City, but still New York City elites, my understanding, were pretty insulated from the broader
masses.
So
he doesn't have as many racist skeletons?
not as many. I'm sure that if you looked, you could find FDR expressing horrific views by our current standards. But despite the fact that he was still, in that era of the Democratic Party, really reliant on a branch of Southern racists, the Democratic Party was still the party of segregation. Not that there weren't Republican elements that were for it, but the Democrats were the traditional party of segregation at that point, and FDR really relied on some of those politicians to get his New Deal program through. Despite all that, there's actually remarkably little indication of FDR's prejudice on FDR's part. I think Truman, I could be entirely wrong about this, and I apologize if I am, but I think there's some indications of, like, Truman had, like, a bit of an anti-Semitism problem. But, like, yeah, for a man born in the 19th century, FDR seems to be surprisingly devoid of prejudice, and it does appear...
Better than the likes of Churchill?
yeah. 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 That's a different podcast. And it really did play through in a number of ways. I think that I perhaps overemphasized the importance of the good neighbor policy in some ways, because in part, as some of my recent readings indicated, that, okay, we withdrew from Nicaragua, but we kind of we did a really good job of cultivating the dictator that quickly replaced the revolutionary hero that won in Nicaragua. So even under the full formal good neighbor policy, we were doing a pretty good job of using our power and wealth and connections to manipulate folks there. But still, it's a real thing that, you know, when FDR came to power, we were occupying half of Latin America. And then by the time FDR left, we were only occupying a quarter or a tenth of Latin America. Like, it was real progress, real respect. Well, I was had a stint about six to 8 months ago reading a lot about China during World War II, specifically the experience of General Stilwell and then General Marshall in two separate books with very different views of things, which is fascinating. Barbara Tuchman's biography of Stilwell, the U.S. general on the ground in China and in Burma during World War II, and then Marshall, the truly epic U.S. World War II fighter, you know, the guy who sat back in Washington, D.C., not the charismatic Eisenhower or Patton, but the general who sat in Washington, D.C. and organized the world for victory, George C. Marshall, and then, of course, the Marshall Plan in Europe. Both of these guys failed in different ways in China, but an ongoing subplot of both of those books was the degree to which FDR, in a somewhat delusional sense, wanted Chiang Kai-shek and China to take a real role in World War II and in the settlement of World War II thereafter. Like, Roosevelt, you can make an argument that Roosevelt personally is the reason why China is on the Security Council of the United Nations. To this day, the Chinese are the only non-white people on the Security Council, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was
There's
FDR's...
talk that Britain might get kicked out and replaced with India, but yeah, as of recording...
I regret to inform Marie that I would be entirely okay with that.
Oh, yeah, I think everyone would.
I don't think that's the thing about the United Nations is these things are settled. Everyone's like, oh, let's kick Russia off. It's like, that's not how that works, buddy.
No.
Like, and I think that the British and the French are likely to be pretty successful for the rest of our lives in defending.
Well,
their,
I think the argument
really,
is kind of, you know, France is symbolizing Europe. But so it's kind of doesn't make sense to have Britain there as well. And, you know, the likes of India would make so much more sense.
Oh, I get and agree with the arguments.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm just
you just
saying
can't see it happening.
The institutional weight, there's so much depends. The powers that the UN has are limited, but they continue to exist. And they are valuable enough that kicking Russia or China or even the UK out of it to come up with an entirely new entity would be so much work and effort that nobody, like the United States, will not, if the U.S. did away with the U.N. or somehow disfavored the U.N., there would be no replacement in the current environment because not the Republicans nor the Democrats would be willing to do the kind of institutional work and pass a treaty. I mean, the United Nations, I believe, there's a ratified U.S. treaty behind the participation we have in the United Nations. So to kick Russia out or switch in India for Britain, that would be too fundamental a change to the organization. You'd need new treaties from the United States, and that would simply not happen in the current political environment. So I think Britain and New France are probably safe. But think about that. In the 1940s, because I think a lot of this constitutive stuff for the United Nations actually happened during the war, when Roosevelt was still alive, China, a country that was non-white and did not have really much power at all, was heavily, heavily subsidized. It was not subsidized quite to the extent that Russia and Britain were, but it was subsidized to a very significant amount, and monies that could have been, that were direly needed on, in the Pacific and Atlantic theaters. And I think that is, that can to some extent be personally credited to FDR. And of course, obviously, we desperately wanted to cater to the Chinese to get them to fight harder against the Japanese, because that was what we needed in the war at the time. So there were, you know, hard geopolitical reasons behind it. I'm not saying he was some kind of like altruist or something, but I do think that is impressive. And I think is something that is not paid a ton of, not enough attention is paid to the fact that from the 1940s, when the United States still was, had formal mechanisms of white supremacy governing most of the country and informal forms of white supremacy everywhere in the country, a U.S. president made it so that China sat on the governing body of the world. And that's I think that's the fundamental respect that FDR had, even if it was only in theory, even if it was backed up only briefly when the exigencies of war and depression made it easy. There was a real respect there for the rest of the world that is, to this day, something that the United States can use more of.
If FDR is so good, please explain to me why killing 6 million pigs and having their carcasses destroyed was a good thing.
Well, what was this? I don't know about that.
One of the farming, agricultural adjustment act.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, this is, I remember this from law school. This is a big, I don't remember the pig specifically. But you have a problem with the common agricultural policy, Rory? This is the same U.S. Farm subsidies, U.S. farm quotas are pretty absurd have been in every era. And also, I'm afraid I must admit, I have not devoted much attention to them. But I do know that the New Deal era was definitely an extension of a lot of these things. The Great Depression, the sometimes forgotten, was to some extent a great agricultural crisis, just as much as it was a great industrial crisis. Arguably, the agricultural crisis started in the 1920s with the Dust Bowl in Oklahoma and what have you. It's an early example of environmental degradation. The problem, one of the most fundamental problems of the Great Depression, was that too much was being produced, agricultural, industrial, what have you. And as an attempt to support prices, I don't know if Roosevelt initiated these practices, but certainly rolled them out at a much broader scale, farms were simply paid to produce less or mandated to produce less. And that specific issue became the center of some landmark Supreme Court cases that I really don't have on my fingertips right now, Ray. But the large-scale pig slaughter definitely sounds like something that would fit under that sin.
And the National Labor Resolution Act, or the Wagner Act?
So the New Deal created a lot of what we deal with. Social Security is obviously the standout. But what was really instructive was the recent Silicon Valley Bank crisis and First Republic. One of my banks went under as well. It's fully irritating. The speed with which that was resolved was, we've spent 40 years in the United States talking about how government sucks and is worthless. But thank God for, I think it's the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which is a wing of the government that not only insured all of those deposits, but has a like crack team, like a SWAT team of accountants that when a bank is found to be insolvent, they will literally show up there at 5 p.m., like lock the doors, start going through the records and open that bank again tomorrow morning to service depositors.
That's incredible.
As a brand, I guess more or less owned by the government. That is a tremendously effective part of the U.S. government that has just quietly operated for the 80 years since FDR was in power. This was in part Herbert Hoover's fault because he was trying to hold Roosevelt to all kinds of requirements that Roosevelt refused to be held to if he had run on doing a number of New Deal type things. But when FDR came to power in April of 1933, he was one of the last presidents to come through under the very much more lengthy lame duck. It used to be the new presidents didn't start until April. Now they start in January, in part because of how bad this situation with Roosevelt and Hoover was. When Roosevelt came to power, every bank in the United States was about to fail, like systemic bank failure for the United States. And the results to that from that are a communist revolution, probably not, but like chaos. And even at that point, the U.S. was so systemically significant to the world in general that that would have been, the Great Depression was already quite apocalyptic, but how much worse could it have been? And FDR, I think at that point is when he issued his famous, "The only thing to fear is fear itself," statements, but also put in very quickly in those first 100 days, I think the first thing he did was a large-scale banking act that instituted the level of stability that banking has had in the United States ever since. It's become very fashionable in the Reagan era to talk about how, oh, FDR didn't do anything. It was really just World War II and all the money we spent, which is funny. I was listening to a podcast recently, and this guy, I think it was Eric Rossway, pointed out, like, that's a rousing endorsement of Keynesianism, right? Like, conservatives have been saying this for 40 years. It's that like, it wasn't the New Deal that dealt with the Depression. It was World War II. So what you're saying is that the Republicans should have let FDR spend more money during the New Deal. Is that what you're saying here? okay. You're pulling my teeth here, but I'll concede the point. I can't speak to the economics of that, the finance of that. I remain mystified by that. But the simple fact that when FDR became president, every bank in the country, and therefore every bank in the world, was about to fail, and then it didn't. And then he somehow held the country together over the 8 years before we got the Keynesian supercharge of Pearl Harbor is miraculous. And it's funny because I think to some extent how adulatory I'm being about FDR in this episode is a result to just how I had been taught for 20 years or 30 years of reading about FDR is just that he has been systematically run down over the past 40 years. And there are reasons to dislike the man. He seems to have been, massively manipulative and, a good, a superb politician with all of the nightmarishness that requires. Wow, is he a significant figure. He built the modern world that we live in. And I am actually very happy. One of the happiest results of the great unpleasantness around George Floyd in 2020 is that we're going to stop giving credit to this Southern bigot, university president idiot, Woodrow Wilson, and start giving credit to FDR, who deserves it.
After his period, this is where you'd see the state a lot more. You'd expect help from a federal government. They'd be a bigger part in your life.
Absolutely. Wilson and FDR contributed to that. I think there's been a recent cult on the right wing of Calvin Coolidge, who was the guy in between Hoover was actually more of a progressive than you'd think. In part, his being in charge when the Great Depression started was just bad luck. But Coolidge in particular was seems to be the only non-progressive president of the first half of the 20th century. That's an overstatement, but not by much, actually. So people really love Coolidge, but the trend in the first half of the 20th century was undeniably towards more government involvement because unignorable that there were things that government did better than the private sector did, especially in the mass industrial environment that was created in the United States in the second half of the 19th century. So, yeah, it's interesting because the political valence on Wilson and FDR, they were both progressive Democrats. One was very successful and one was not. I mean, Woodrow Wilson, this is so Woodrow Wilson is the guy who came up with the income tax and used it to create Hitler. That's...
That is quite a legacy.
Yeah, right? Right? I should probably expand on that a little bit. I think that I'm sort of the opinion that Germany was kind of, once it solidified, it was kind of destined to have a larger role in Europe than France or Britain would have liked. And I think they spent 4 years in World War One proving that and should have been allowed to win that. And it's really the imbalance that Wilson created by putting his finger on the scales that led to World War II, the Cold War, the power of the Soviet Union, all manner of nightmarish results, the Holocaust. Woodrow Wilson, I don't like him.
But you do love FDR, but not S-tier, just A-tier.
Yeah, no, definitely not. What is S-tier? Is that a video game
thing? S-tier is like super.
Yes.
It's the, like A-star.
Yeah. So S tier, and then Washington be like A+, and then like FDR be like A. I'm like, is anybody else really? I don't think anybody else really is that great, frankly.
So is this the biggest gulf between two presidents within, you know, that would have known each other, would have been similar eras?
Yeah, too. I think was FDR in Wilson's cabinet. I guess I don't have those details on my fingertips, sadly. It's basically they had similar tasks in front of them.
And similar opportunities.
Similar opportunities, and Wilson and, you know, similar political constituencies. And Wilson failed utterly, and FDR succeeded. In Wilson's defense, FDR was, two decades later stronger. FDR's United States was a two decades later stronger entity. And for sure, Europe, after its second bout of self-destruction, was in even worse straits. You know, in 1920, the French and British empires could have been pushed around by the United States, but it would have been harder. In 1945, France and Britain and the rest of the world, frankly, were just desperate for U.S. handouts. So there are reasons why FDR was so much more successful than Wilson was. But I also think it has a lot to do with their personalities and their capabilities and, frankly, just knowledge of the world.
And that is why FDR is much better than Woodrow Wilson. I'd just like to say thank you very much for listening. And next week's episode will be about the BRICS and why they're maybe not as good as you've been led to believe. Thank you very much for listening, and I'd like to wish you all the very best.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.